tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Ted Midward. This is Caucasian Christian Communications. Henry Ford's The International Jew. Did the Jews foresee the World War? To which I would most assuredly answer yes, right? So let's start with the text here. Before proceeding to a more detailed study of the connection between the written program of the documents, which are called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, and the actual program, as it can be traced in real life, we shall now view those plans which were future when the protocols were uttered. It must be borne in mind, however, that what was future in 1896 and 1905 may be past today. That what was the plan then may be fulfillment now. To bear this in mind will be in exact accord with the expression of Protocol number 22, which reads, quote, "I have endeavored to indicate carefully the secrets of past and future events, and of those momentous occurrences of the near future toward which we are rushing in a stream of great crises." Some of those momentous occurrences, as they're called, have come to pass, and with them a brighter light on the question which we are studying. An illustration of this, which is fresh in the minds of all, was furnished by the Great War. Jewish comment on this series of articles has made much of the fact that one of the articles was devoted to the then prominence of the Jewish question in Germany, and it was sought to mislead the people to think that this series was really a part of subtle German after-the-war propaganda. The fact is that articles on the question in a number of countries were set aside in order to bring the question itself prominently before the minds of Americans with the least delay. The postponed articles will appear in due season, though out of their order. Germany is today, with perhaps the possible exception of the United States, the most Jew-controlled country in the world, controlled within and from without, and a much stronger set of facts could be presented now than was presented in the original article. The facts of which were at first denied and then later admitted by the Jewish spokesmen in the United States. For since that article was written, public sentiment in Germany has swept the Jews largely out of public office. German public opinion exerted itself to the utmost to put German political administration back into German hands. But did that liberate Germany from the Jews? Not at all. For their entrenchments stretched further and deeper than mere display of official power. Their hold on the basic industries, the finances, the future of Germany has not been loosened in the least. It is there, unmovable. And what that hold consists, the reader will be told at some convenient time. Germany is mentioned now, in connection with the Jews, for this purpose. It will be remembered that it was from Germany that the first outcry of annexations came. And it came at a time when all German war activities and war sentiment were admittedly in Jewish control. Annexations, so-called, was the cry that flashed across the world one day. And back across the world, from the United States, a nation that was not even a party to the war at that time, the word flashed back. No annexations. Thus, by a dramatic play, the whole question was thrust before the world. Soon the people of all countries had forgotten the blood of battle, the war profiteers, and every other vital point, and were discussing a matter which belonged to the end of the war and not the beginning, the question of annexations. Now, when it is known who were controlling the formulation of war aims in Germany, and who were the chief counselors of the foreign policy of the U.S. at the same time, the projection of this question of annexations into the world's mind becomes interesting. Interesting, but not wholly intelligible. Not until you read the protocols do you get a full light on this. And this report of the protocols, which is now given the world, probably dates from 1896. There's absolutely ironclad proof of the date of 1905. The second protocol begins on the note of war, and its opening words are these, quote, "It is indispensable for our purpose that, as far as possible, wars should bring no territorial advantages. This will shift war to an economic footing, and nations will perceive the strength of our superiority in the aid we render." Who was thinking, between 1896 and 1905, of the new no annexations rule to be applied to war? Were you? Do you know of any statesman who was? We know that military men were concerned about the appliances and operations of any future war that might occur. We know that statesmen, of the more responsible sort, were working to consolidate a balance of interests that would make war extremely improbable. Who had outdistanced them all in foresight in planning sufficiently to lay down a definite program of no annexations? Fortunately, the clue to the answer is supplied to us by the unquestionable Jewish sources. The American Jewish News of September 19th, 1919, had an advertisement on its front page which read thus, "When Prophets Speak," by Lippmann Rosenthal. Many years ago, Nordau prophesied the Balfour Declaration. Lippmann Rosenthal, his intimate friend, relates this incident in a fascinating memoir. The article on page 464 begins, quote, "It was on Saturday, the day after the closing of the Sixth Congress, when I received a telephone message from Dr. Herzl asking me to call on him." This fixes the time. The Sixth Zionist Congress was held at Basel, Switzerland, that would be, in August of 1903. The memoir continues, quote, "On entering the lobby of the hotel, I met Herzl's mother, who welcomed me with her usual gracious friendliness and asked me whether the feelings of the Russian Zionists were now calmer. Why just the Russian Zionists, Frau Herzl?" I asked. "Why do you only inquire about these?" "Because my son," she explained, "is mostly interested in the Russian Zionists. He considers them the quintessence, the most vital part of the Jewish people." At the Sixth Congress, the British government had offered the Jews a colony in Uganda, East Africa. Herzl was in favor of taking it, not as a substitute for Palestine, but as a step toward it. It was this which formed the chief topic of conversation between Herzl and Lippmann Rosenthal at that Basel hotel. Herzl said to Rosenthal, as reported in this article, quote, "There is a difference between the final aim and the ways we have to go to achieve this aim." Suddenly, Max Nordau, who seems at the conference held last month in London to have become Herzl's successor, entered the room, and the Herzl interview was ended. Let the reader now follow attentively the most important part of the Rosenthal story. About a month later, I went on a business trip to France. On my way to Lyons, I stopped in Paris, and there I visited, as usual, our Zionist friends. One of them told me that this very same evening, Dr. Nordau was scheduled to speak about the Sixth Congress, and I, naturally, interrupted my journey to be present at this meeting and to hear Dr. Nordau's report. When we reached the hall in the evening, we found it filled to overflowing, and we were waiting impatiently for the great master, Nordau, who, on entering, received a tremendous ovation. But Nordau, without paying heed to the applause showered upon him, began his speech immediately and said, "You all came here with a question burning in your hearts and trembling on your lips, and the question is, indeed, a great one, and of vital importance. I am willing to answer it. What you want to ask is, how could I? I was one of those who formulated the Basel program. How could I dare speak in favor of the English proposition concerning Uganda? How could Herzl, as well as I, betray our ideal of Palestine? Because you surely think that we have betrayed it and forgotten it. Yet, listen to what I have to say to you. I spoke in favor of Uganda after long and careful consideration. Deliberately, I advised the Congress to consider and to accept the proposal of the English government, a proposal made to the Jewish nation through the Zionist Congress, and my reasons. But instead of my reasons, let me tell you a political story as a kind of allegory. I want to speak of a time which is now almost forgotten, a time when the European powers had decided to send a fleet against the fortress of Sebastopol. At this time, Italy, the United Kingdom of Italy, did not exist. Italy was in reality only a little principality of Sardinia, and the great, free, and united Italy was but a dream, a fervent wish, a far ideal of all Italian patriots. The leaders of Sardinia, who were fighting for and planning this free and united Italy, were the three great popular heroes, Garibaldi, Mazzini, and Cavour. The European powers invited Sardinia to join in the demonstration at Sebastopol and to send also a fleet to help in the siege of this fortress, and this proposal gave rise to a dissension among the leaders of Sardinia. Garibaldi and Mazzini did not want to send a fleet to the help of England and France. They said, "Our program, the work to which we are pledged, is a free and united Italy. What have we to do with Sebastopol? Sebastopol is nothing to us, and we should concentrate all our energies on our original program so that we may realize our ideal as soon as possible." But Cavour, who even at this time was the most prominent, the most able, and the most far-sighted statesman of Sardinia, insisted that his country should send a fleet and beleaguer with the other powers Sebastopol, and, at least, he carried his point. Perhaps it will interest you to know that the right hand of Cavour, his friend and advisor, was his secretary, Hardam, a Jew. And in those circles, which were in opposition to the government, one spoke fulminantly of Jewish treason, and at once an assembly of Italian patriots, one called wildly for Cavour's secretary Hardam, and demanded of him to defend his dangerous and treasonable political actions. And this is what he said, "Our dream, our fight, our ideal, an ideal for which we have paid already in blood and tears and sorrow and despair, with the life of our sons and the anguish of our mothers, our one wish and one aim is a free and united Italy. All means are sacred if they lead to this great and glorious goal." Cavour knows full well that after the fight before Sebastopol, sooner or later a peace conference will have to be held, and at this peace conference, those powers will participate who have joined in the fight. True, Sardinia has no immediate concern, no direct interest in Sebastopol. But if we will help now with our fleet, we will sit at the future peace conference enjoying equal rights with the other powers, and at this peace conference, Cavour, as the representative of Sardinia, will proclaim the free and independent United Italy. Thus our dream, for which we have suffered and died, will become, at last, a wonderful and happy reality. And if you now ask me again, what has Sardinia to do at Sebastopol, then let me tell you the following words, like the steps of a ladder. Cavour, Sardinia, the siege of Sebastopol, the future European peace conference, the proclamation of a free and united Italy. The whole assembly was under the spell of Nordau's beautiful, truly poetic and exalted diction, and his exquisite, musical French delighted the hearers with an almost sensual pleasure. For a few seconds, the speaker paused, and the public, absolutely intoxicated by his splendid oratory, applauded frantically. But soon, Nordau asked for silence and continued. Now, this great progressive world power, England, has, after the programs of Kishinev, in token of her sympathy with our poor people, offered through the Zionist Congress the autonomous colony of Uganda to the Jewish nation. Of course, Uganda is in Africa, and Africa is not Zion, and never will be Zion, to quote Herzl's own words. But Herzl knows full well that nothing is so valuable to the cause of Zionism as an amicable political relations with such a power as England is, and so much more valuable as England's main interest is concentrated in the Orient. Nowhere else is precedent as powerful as in England, and so it is most important to accept a colony out of the hands of England and create thus a precedent in our favor. Sooner or later, the Oriental question will have to be solved, and the Oriental question means, naturally, also, the question of Palestine. England, who had addressed a formal political note to the Zionist Congress, the Zionist Congress which is pledged to the Basel Program, England will have the deciding voice in the final solution of the Oriental question, and Herzl has considered it his duty to maintain valuable relations with this great and progressive power. Herzl knows that we stand before a tremendous upheaval of the whole world. Soon, perhaps, some kind of a world congress will have to be called, and England, the great, free, and powerful England, will then continue the work it has begun with its generous offer to the Sixth Congress. And if you ask me now, what has Israel to do in Uganda, then let me tell you, as the answer the words of the statesman of Sardinia, only applied to our case and given our version, let me tell you the following words as if I were showing you the rungs of a ladder leading upward and forward. Herzl, the Zionist Congress, the English-Uganda proposition, the future world war, the peace conference, where, with the help of England, a free and Jewish Palestine will be created. Like a mighty thunder, these last words came to us, and we were all trembling and awestruck, as if we had seen a vision of old, and in my ears were the sounding words of our great brother, Akhed Haim, who said of Nordau's address at the First Congress, I felt that one of the great old prophets was speaking to us, that his voice came down from the free hills of Judea, and our hearts were burning in us when we heard his words, filled with wonder, wisdom, and vision. The amazing thing is that this article by Lippmann Rosenthal should ever have been permitted to see print, but it did not see print until the Balfour Declaration about Palestine, and it never would have seen the print had the Jews not believed that one part of their program had already been accomplished. The Jew never betrays himself until he believes that what he seeks has been won. Then he lets himself go. It was only to Jews that the 1903 program of the latter, the future world war, the peace conference, the Jewish program, was communicated. When the ascent of that latter seemed to be complete, then came the public talk. A similar illustration of this is to be found in the fall of the Tsar. When that event transpired, it was an occasion of great rejoicing in New York, and a Gentile of worldwide fame made a speech in which he lauded an American Jew of national reputation for having begun the downfall of the Tsar by providing the money with which propaganda had been made among Russian prisoners in Japan during the Russo-Japanese War. The story came out only after the success of the plot. It is not at all out of the keeping that the last men to see the last act of the plot carried out, the actual murder of Nicholas Romanovich, his wife, his young daughters, and his invalid boy were, quote, five Soviet deputies, the latter five all Jews, end quote. What began with the assistance of an American financier finished with Soviet deputies. Did international Jews in 1903 foresee the war? That being World War I, the Great War? This Rosenthal confession is but one bit of evidence that they did. And did they do nothing but foresee it? It were well if the facts stopped at foresight and did not run on to provocation. For the present reader is invited to retain in his mind 2 points in this Rosenthal article. Perhaps it will interest you to know that the right hand of Cavour, his friend and advisor, was a secretary, Hardam, a Jew. This is the way the Jewish press speaks of its own. If this paper, or a Chicago paper, or a New York paper, should go through the list of the secretaries of the men of power in the world today and make note of their names, his secretary, a Jew, the Anti-Defamation Society would send letters of protest. There is one rule for the Gentile and one for the Jew in the Jewish mind. Writing in the public prints about Hardam, he would be described as an Italian. Were the Jewish secretaries, who abounded before the war, during the war, and throughout the peace conference, of less brilliance than Hardam? Were there not Hardams in England, France, Germany? Yes, and in Russia too, and in the United States there were many, who saw the, quote, program of the latter, the tiptoe to what you want? Did Max Nordau, who saw it so clearly in 1903, forget it in 1914 and 1918? We know this. The Jews in their Congress at Basel, Switzerland in 1903 foresaw the future world war. How did they know it was to be a world war, as they call it? We also know this. The protocols, perhaps as early as 1896, certainly not later than 1905, foresaw the policy of no annexations. The World War came to pass. No annexations as a policy came to pass. What was then future in the Jewish world program is now past. In the protocols, there are 2 forms of declaration. One is, we have, and the other is, we shall. If somewhere in the world this summer the high secret spokesman of the world program is addressing his class of international initiates, he will have to say, we have, in many places where this spokesman of 1896 said, we shall. Things have been accomplished. We will represent ourselves as the saviors of the laboring classes. That has been and is being done. We will deflect the thoughts of the Gentiles to industry and commerce. That has been done. We will create a strongly centralized administration so as to grasp all the social forces strongly in our hands. That has been done. We will adopt for ourselves the liberal side of all parties and all movements and provide orators. That has been done. We will force up wages. That has been done. We will at the same time cause a rise in the price of prime necessities. That, too, has been done. We will also undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy. That has been done. Here's an excerpt from Protocol 7. Quote, to demonstrate our enslavement of the Gentile governments of Europe, we shall show our power to one by crimes of violence, that is, by a reign of terror. End quote. Does that sound familiar, folks? Who that sees Russia and beholds the attitude of the premiers of England, France, and Italy towards the Soviets, the enslavement of statesmanship by a condition that tangles more gnarledly the more it is dealt with, who that sees the prostration of Europe before a wound that is deliberately kept from healing can forbear to say, that too has been done. Here's another excerpt, another quote. Our plans will not upset contemporary institutions immediately. Their management will only be altered, and consequently the whole procedure of their activity will thus be directed according to plans laid down by us. End quote. That has been done. We shall saddle the press and keep a tight rein upon it. That has been done. The rein is being strongly pulled in the United States at this moment, as many an editor can testify. Even if there should be those who desire to write against us, no one will print their writings. In large part, that has been done. It has been done completely with the profit-making press. We shall, as an incentive to speculation, encourage among the Gentiles a strong demand for luxuries, all enticing luxuries. That, too, has been done. Here's an excerpt from Protocol 7. To each act of opposition, we must be in a position to respond by bringing on war through the neighbors of any country that dares to oppose us. And if these neighbors should plan to stand collectively against us, we must let loose a world war. Interesting. The term world war is the same as that used by Rosenthal and Nordau. Herzl knows, said Nordau in 1903, that we stand before a tremendous upheaval of the whole world. Here's another excerpt from the Protocols. We must create unrest, dissension, and mutual animosities throughout Europe, and, with the help of her relationships, on other continents. This has been done. The passage continues. There is a double advantage in this. First, we shall command the respect of all countries by this method, for they will realize that we have the power to create disorder or establish order at will. This, too, has been done. Truly did the spokesman of 1896 speak of, quote, those momentous occurrences of the near future toward which we are rushing in a stream of great crises. Not only was the no annexations policy achieved as far as possible, just as the protocols had outlined it, but a host of other plans have matured in achievement along with it. No annexations, as a matter of political morality, is one thing, and no annexations for the reason that this will shift war to an economic footing and nations will perceive the strength of our superiority in the aid we render, is quite another thing. The world was with the no annexations program as a matter of political morality. The other program, which used this morality as its vehicle, was hidden. There are still other matters in this group which must receive attention, but another article will be necessary to do it. In the meantime, it is natural to wonder whether, with the program as outlined in the report of the protocols having received fulfillment in so many particulars, a new protocol, or a further unfolding of the latter, has been made by the wise men to their initiates, and whether any additional unveiling will ever come to the knowledge of the world. It would seem that a proper estimate of the knowledge now available would lead to such an awakening as to nullify the present program and make all future ones impossible. But Gentiles like their ease, and Judah is beckoned on by a bright star. That's the end of this particular article. This was published August 21st, 1920. Again, the title of this article is Did the Jews Foresee the World War? Since we're finished with the article and we do have some time to comment here, I will say that there's undoubtedly, did the Jews see the war, if not provoke it and bring it on themselves. The Balfour Declaration is really the smoking gun in all this. The Balfour Declaration was a deal that the Rothschilds set up with the British government of that time, which said, hey, if you give us Jews a homeland in the state of Palestine, an exclusively Jewish homeland in Palestine, we will bring America into World War I and help you win the war. And of course, they had their agents in the 19-teens, I'll say, with Woodrow Wilson and his particular handler, who I believe was Colonel Edward Mandel House, and maybe Henry Morgenthau. I'm throwing that second name in there just straight off memory. I could be mistaken. But Wilson was essentially another Zionist stooge president. He had had he was blackmailed into doing what he did with World War I and probably the Federal Reserve and the ADL in 1913, not opposing those two, because he was blackmailed when he was teaching at, I think it was Princeton or Stanford, one of those two universities, and he was having an affair with another woman. And they used this as blackmail pressure against him and then promoted him to the position of president because they had dirt on him. You got to remember, at the time of World War I, Britain controlled all of, if not most of, the Middle East after the war because they had defeated the Ottoman Empire, which controlled the Middle East and Asia Minor to a great extent at that time. And the Jews seeing an opening to get Palestine and create a home base for their international operations wisely seized upon it and used the influence of Rothschild to get that done with the help of the British government. Not only did they have the Balfour Declaration signed off and enacted, but they even went so far as using terrorist measures like the King David Hotel bombing to finally wrench away and drive the British totally out of Palestine. You can read more about that elsewhere on your own time. I can't get too far into this commentary because I don't have that much time, but essentially, yes, the Jews planned coordinated World War I just as they did World War II, and like Henry Ford said, war is the Jews' harvest. Now let's move on to the next part here. Okay, we are moving on to the second half. This particular article is entitled, Is the Jewish Kahal the Modern Soviet? The Soviet is not a Russian, but a Jewish institution. Nor is it the invention of Russian Jews of the present time, a new political device which has been set up as a vehicle of the ideas of Lenin and Trotsky. It is of ancient Jewish origin, a device which the Jews themselves invented to maintain their distinctive racial and national life after the conquest of Palestine by the Romans. Modern Bolshevism, which is now known to be merely the outer cloak of a long-planned coup to establish the domination of a race, immediately set up by the Soviet form of government because the Jews of all countries who contributed to Russian Bolshevism had long been schooled in the nature of the structure of the Soviet. The Soviet appears in the protocols of the learned elders of Zion under the ancient name of Kahal, K-A-H-A-L. In the 17th protocol, this passage occurs, quote, Even now, our brothers, under obligation to denounce apostates of their own family or any person known to be opposed to the Kahal, when our kingdom comes, it will be necessary for all subjects to serve the state in a similar manner. Anyone who's acquainted with contemporary Jewish life knows what this denunciation of apostates means. The bitterness of the persecution which falls upon a convert to Christianity or upon the Jewish son or daughter of an Orthodox family who chooses to marry a Gentile is without parallel among men. Very recently, in a Western state, a fine Jewish girl chose to marry a Gentile, who was a newspaperman. From the time of her announcement of intention, the girl was treated as an apostate. Had she died a most wretched death, had she descended to a status of most ignominious shame, the feelings which her fate would have aroused could not have been more terrible. A darkly solemn funeral service was held for her, and on her bridal day, she was declared to be dead by her people. The case is very far from being unusual. Perhaps one of the most moving descriptions of it is to be found in the life of Spinoza, the great philosopher whom modern Jews are fond of holding up for exhibition as a great ornament of their people. Spinoza's studies led him to question many of the dogmas the rabbis taught, those commandments of men of which the New Testament speaks, and as Spinoza was already a person of influence, the very common Jewish tactic of bribery was tried upon him. There would be some hesitation in using the words just set down, the very common Jewish tactic of bribery, if they were not known to be true. There is no desire to cast aspersions which grow out of malice, but Jewish history, as written by Jews, provides mountains of proof that bribery was, while present knowledge amply testifies that it still is, the favorite and most dependable weapon of the Jews. A Jewish writer, Jacob Israel de Haan, a Dutch lawyer resident in Jerusalem, has recently stated that one hope of a settlement of the Arab agitation in Palestine is the case with which the Arab press can be bribed. His words are, quote, "There's a strong agitation here among the Arabs against what they call the Zionist peril, but the Arabs, especially the Arabian papers, are open to bribe. This weakness will cause them, in the long run, to lose out against us." So, young Spinoza was offered an annual stipend of 1,000 florins if he would be silent upon his convictions and from time to time show himself at the synagogue. This he refused with high-minded scorn. He made ready to earn his bread by polishing lenses for optical instruments. Upon this, he was excommunicated, a proceeding which is thus described. The day of excommunication at length arrived, and a vast concourse assembled to witness the awful ceremony. It began by the silent and solemn lighting of a quantity of black wax candles, and by the opening of the tabernacle wherein is deposited the books of the law of Moses. Thus were the imaginations of the faithful prepared for all the horror of the scene. The chief rabbi, the ancient friend and master, now the fiercest enemy of the condemned, was to order the execution. He stood there pained, but not implacable. The people fixed their eager eyes upon him. High above, the chanter rose and chanted forth, in loud, lugubrious tones, the words of execration. While from the opposite side another mingled with these curses the thrilling sounds of the trumpet. And now the black candles were reversed and were made to melt, drop by drop, into a huge tub filled with blood. That's from Lou's Biographical History of Philosophy. And then came the final anathema. With the judgment of the angels and of the saints, we excommunicate, cut off, curse, and anathematize Baruch de Espinoza with the consent of the elders and all this holy congregation in the presence of the holy books, by the 613 precepts which are written therein, and the anathema therewith Joshua cursed Jericho, with the curse of Elisha laid upon the children, and with all the curses which are written in the law. Cursed be he by day, and cursed be he by night. Cursed be he in sleeping, and cursed be he in waking. Cursed in going out, cursed in coming in. The Lord shall not pardon him. The wrath and the fury of the Lord shall henceforth be kindled against this man, and shall lay upon him all the curses written in the book of the law. The Lord shall destroy his name under the sun, and cut him off for his undoing from all the tribes of Israel, with all the curses of the firmament which are written in the law. And we warn you that none may speak with him by word of mouth, nor by writing, nor show any favor unto him, nor be under one roof with him, nor come within 4 cubits of him, nor read any paper composed by him. That's from Pollock, Life of Spinoza. As the blasting words were uttered, the lights were all suddenly immersed in the blood. A cry of religious horror and execration burst from all. And in that solemn darkness, to those solemn curses, they shouted, "Amen! Amen!" That is a commentary on the decree of denunciation. It also throws a very strong light on the pressure which is brought against many Jews who would cry out in the antisocial ideas of their people, but who dare not because of the penalties it would bring. This denunciation, as Protocol 17 orders, is to be made against anyone who is known to be opposed to the Kahal or ancient Soviet system of the Jews. After the destruction of the Jewish state by the Romans, the Jews maintained a center in the Patriarch, and after the dispersion of the Jews out of Palestine, this center of nationality was preserved in the Prince of the Exile, or Exilarch, an office which is believed to persist to the present time, and which some believe to be held now by an American Jew. In spite of all the assertions to the contrary, the Jews have never ceased to be a people. That is, a consciously united racial group, different from all others, and with purposes and ideals which are strictly of the Jews, by the Jews, and for the Jews, in distinction from the rest of the world. That they constitute a nation within the nations, the most responsible Jewish thinkers not only declare, but insist upon, and this is wholly in accord with the facts as observed. The Jew not only desires to live apart from other people, but he works with his own people as against others, and he desires as much as possible to live under his own laws. In the city of New York today, the Jews have succeeded in establishing their own court for the settlement of their own questions according to their own laws, and that is precisely the principle of the Soviet Kahal. From the first century forward, as any reader can see by consulting the Jewish Encyclopedia, the community, assembly, or kahal has been the center of Jewish life. It was so earlier, in the time of the Babylonian captivity. And the last official appearance of it was at the peace conference, where the Jews, in accordance with their world program, the only program that passed successfully and unchanged through the peace conference, secured for themselves the right to the Kahal for the administrative and cultural purposes, in addition to many other privileges in countries where their activities had been a matter of protest. The Polish question is purely a Jewish question, and Paderewski's failure as a statesman was entirely due to his domination by Jewish influences. The Romanian question is likewise a Jewish question, and all Romanians speak of the United States as the Jews' country, because they know their statesmen, they know through their statesmen the terrific pressure which was exerted by American Jews against their country, a pressure extending to the very necessities of life, and which compelled Romania to sign agreements which are as humiliating as those that Austria asked of Serbia, out of which the World War grew. The Jewish question is written all over the forces that provoked the war, and all over the hindrances to peace which the world has since seen. Under the Kahal, or ancient Soviet, the Jews lived by themselves and governed themselves, doing business with the government solely through their representatives. It was communism in a more drastic form than has been seen anywhere in the world outside of Russia. Education, health, taxes, domestic affairs, all were under the absolute control of a few men who constituted the ruling board. This board, as the present-day Jewish hierarchy is supposed to be, was self-perpetuating, the office often passing in an unbroken line of hereditary succession through many generations. All property was in common, which, however, did not prevent the leaders becoming rich. These Cahals, or Soviets, existed in Rome, France, Holland, Germany, Austria, Denmark, Italy, Romania, Turkey, and England. In the United States, the idea has developed around the synagogue and around national and international secret societies of Jews, of which more will be said in succeeding articles. The Cahal is the traditional Jewish political institution during the dispersal of the race among the nations. Its international aspect is to be seen in the higher councils. These councils enlarged as the Jews spread over the world. The Jewish Encyclopedia cites the Council of Three Lands, the Council of Four Lands, the Council of Five Lands, showing an international relationship in earlier years. But, like all such records, public view of them is not easily accessible so far as they relate to modern times. The recent Zionist Congress in London, where doubtless much business was done that pertained to the Jewish people throughout the world, though not in public halls by any means, may be called the Council of 37 Lands, for the delegates to that Congress came from all parts of the world, from points remote as Lapland in South Africa, Persia, and New Zealand. The purpose of these world councils was the unification of the Jews, and the records of their assemblages run back through the centuries. It's therefore no new thing that has arisen in Russia. It is the imposition by the Jewish revolutionists upon Gentile Russia of a form of control in which Judaism has been schooled from the earliest times of its contact with the world. Soviet Russia could have not been possible had not 90% of the commissars been Jewish. Soviet Hungary could not have been possible had not Bela Kun, the chief Red, been a Jew, and had not 18 of his 24 commissars been Jews as well. The Jews are the only group schooled in the erection and administration of the Cahal. As an Associated Press dispatch under the date of August 12th, throws light on the congeniality of the Soviet system in the Jewish mind. Speaking of the Polish towns and villages occupied by Bolshevik forces in their recent drive, the dispatch says, quote, "The local Jewish parish populations already are said to be setting up Soviet and communist governments." Of course, yet this is in strange contrast with what we are constantly told through the press of the sufferings of the Jews under the Soviet form and of their abhorrence of the Reds. However, most of what we read concerning this in the public press is Jewish propaganda, pure and simple, and the reports of men on the spot contradict it all. One relief worker testifies that relief work in Poland is frequently, quote, "hung up because some Jew landlord asks an exorbitant rent for his premises," while another testifies that, though railroad fares in the supposedly famine-stricken districts have gone up 1,000%, the best and highest fare trains are, quote, "exclusively occupied by Jews." He adds, of his trip through Hungary, "the Hungarians have no money anymore, but the Jews have." "But American Jews abhor Trotsky and Sovietism," is the plea that's sometimes made. Do they? On page 9 of the American Jewish World of July 30th, a letter signed Mrs. Samuel Rush appears. It's headed, "Are We Really Ashamed of Trotsky?" Let's read a few excerpts from it. "I have read of late several laments from editors of Jewish publications that the Jew is now libeled as a radical. It is true that many Jews are radicals. It is also true that some of the radical leaders are Jews. But before weeping over the downfall of the race, let's think a bit. Trotsky himself has never been represented as anything but a cultured man, a student of world economics, a powerful and efficient leader and thinker, who will surely go down in history as one of the great men our race has given the world. Very few of us doubt any longer that behind the absurdities written about Russia is the great truth that Russia is in that unsettled state which attends Reconstruction. There is a plan behind this seeming disorder, and out of the upheaval will come order. It will not be utopia, but as good a government as the undoubtedly high-minded practical idealists who are building for Russia can build with the necessarily imperfect materials, that being human beings, with which they must work. And one of the leaders is Leon Trotsky. Are we really ashamed of Trotsky? The lady is evidently not ashamed of Trotsky, or Mr. Brownstein, as his real name is. Or take Judge Harry Fisher of Chicago. While drawing a salary for work in the court, Judge Fisher went abroad on Jewish relief work. His plans were changed somewhat after his departure and he landed in Russia. He asserts in several interviews that he was permitted to arrive in Russia on condition that he leave political matters alone. There has been no such restriction placed upon him since his return to the United States, for he appears as an open advocate of full trade relations with the Soviet government of Russia. The Chicago Tribune quotes him as saying this, "We must leave Russia alone," he said in summarizing his views. "We should resume trade with the Soviet. The Bolshevist government is permanent. While there are only 700,000 members of the Communist Party, the peasants, who represent almost 100 million people, are solidly back of the Lenin regime." Among the Soviet devices which the 100 million peasants of Russia are said to be solidly back of is the following. And let's note here, too, it's particularly interesting in view of the fact that Judge Fisher is the judge of the Morals Court of Chicago. It says this, quote, "Some time ago, it was published that the women of Russia had become national property," he said. "That is untrue. But the ease with which marriage and divorce may be effected makes for rapid changes. Everyone wanting to marry goes to what we would call the city hall and registers. Inducements to marry are great. When people are hard-pressed for clothes and food, they sometimes make a pact to wed for a day. The next day, they go down to the city hall and register again. This time, their names are put side by side in the divorce book. That's all that's necessary to be divorced, and they can have a good feed in the bargain." Judge Harry Fisher of Chicago, who has returned from Jewish relief work abroad, evidently is one with the others not being ashamed of Trotsky. Also, Max Pine, for many years Secretary of the United Hebrew Trades of New York, had been abroad in Soviet Russia as a labor delegate. He, too, had many good things to say of the Soviets. Among other things, the strange contradiction that the Jews are doing very well in Russia, but are not pro-Bolshevik. Here are three persons from widely different spheres of life, yet each one of them indicates a natural liking for the Cabal or the Soviet, an admiration of its methods, and a distinct good feeling towards its rulers. For Sovietism is the highest rank form of autocracy, and the marriage laws of Soviet Russia are in full harmony with the program stated in the protocols, which is this, quote, "We will break down the influence of family life among the Gentiles." Whether the Soviet Cabals of Russia will succeed in completely undermining Russian family life is extremely doubtful. The weakness of Soviet rule is the same as that of the protocols, a moral weakness that must eat like a cancer until it destroys the institutions which it infests. Russia today, viewed in the light of the protocols, does not represent the Judaic state, but it represents the Gentile state seized by Jewish forces. There are three degrees of action set forth in the protocols. There is, first, the secret process of breaking up the integrity of society by the admixture of alluring but disruptive ideas. This is a work in which Gentile agitators are used. When the ideas have worked sufficiently to break up society and explode in a crisis, then, as in Germany, The forces that have worked in secret swiftly come to the front to take the reins and guide the riot. In Germany, this immediately occurred upon the collapse which followed the armistice, but the Germans were wise enough to know the meaning of the influx of Jews into all official positions of the former empire, and it was not long before they were politically ousted. In Russia, however, the Jews sprang immediately into official positions and have succeeded in remaining there. It began with Kerensky compelling the Tsar to lay aside his crown. It continues with Trotsky and his armies at the throat of Europe. But this seizure of a country, as was attempted in Germany, and as was not only attempted but succeeded in Russia, is not the end of the program. It is only the beginning of its open or public phase. The Soviet Cabal makes for the complete breaking up of society, the entire cutting off of cooperation and communication, the ruling of each little section in the way desired until the whole country lies helpless in isolated bits. The process includes, of course, the disintegration of industry also, the massing of Gentiles into an army, and a general destruction of morality and order. It is the protocol program in its last stage before the reconstruction begins, which shall make the conquered country a Jewish state. The world has not seen that last stage yet. It has not come, even in Russia. If the Russian people waken from the days into which they have been thrust, it will not come. Jewish voices loudly proclaim that Soviet Russia has come to stay. The only authoritative voice on that subject is the voice of Russia, and Russia has not yet spoken. Today, the world is trembling on the very verge of real Russia's awakening, and with it, a retribution most terrible upon the Sovietists. The program of the protocols once came near succeeding in the French Revolution, but its essential immorality overreached itself. It has come a step nearer success in Russia, but there too, its defiance of the moral law will be its undoing. The Jewish question of today is being fought out in Russia and Poland, and the strength of the Jewish forces is largely and mostly supplied from the United States of America. No wonder those small East European independencies which are fighting for their lives refer to our country as the land of the Jews. "We will show our power to one," says the protocols, "in order to demonstrate our enslavement of the Gentile governments of Europe. We shall show our power to one of them by crimes of violence, that is, by a reign of terror." That's from Protocol 7. One by one, the Gentile nations of Europe have been compelled to withdraw their troops from Russia. One by one, the premiers of Europe have submitted to heavy shackling of their official hands with regard to the Russian question. And today, the world looks on while little Poland, apparently the second country on the list of Soviet victims, is made to feel heavy vengeance for her daring to be independent of Jewish power. Russia has been made to pay for her attempted independence of the Jew. Poland is now being made to pay. It is a flame, the Jews of Eastern Europe hope, and many Jews of America also, which will sweep round the world. If the ruling Jews of the world wished the Russian people freed, if they wished the flames of Bolshevism to be quenched, if they wished Jewish participation in revolutionary movements to be withdrawn, they could accomplish it in a week. What's going on today is going on by permission of the Jewish world powers. There's apparently no desire to curtail a movement which largely originated in American Jewry. This is the program of showing our power to one, and the program will be followed out. The showing, however, is twofold. It is a showing of power, but it's also a showing of the people who wield the power, and in the end, it might have been just as well had the power never been coveted, attained, or used. Anyone who desires to test the exactitude of the protocol's estimate of human nature may do so by observing his own reactions to the Russian Bolshevist situation. It's undeniable that there exists, among all classes of Gentiles in America, a kind of admiration for the coup which Lenin and Trotsky have managed on such a massive scale. The audacity of it, the ability to stay afloat thus long in defiance of so many laws, have conspired to draw out unwilling applause. Consider, then, this passage from the 10th Protocol. The people feel an especial love and respect toward the genius who wields political power, and they say, of all his high-handed actions, it is base but clever. It is a trick, but how he played it, so majestic, so impudent. We count on attracting all nations to the constructive work of laying the foundations for the structure planned by us. It is necessary for us, first of all, to acquire the services of bold and fearless agents who will overcome all obstacles in our pathway. When we accomplish our governmental coup d'etat, we will say to the people, everything has gone badly. All have suffered. We will eliminate the cause of your sufferings, nationality, frontiers, and diversity of coinage. Of course, you are free to pronounce sentence upon us, but that can scarcely be just if you do so before giving a trial to that which we offer to you. This is very well conceived, and this is the way in which, up to this time, it's worked out. But there will be a strong reaction set in. False promises, like chickens, have come home to roost. The real originators, the real purpose of the movement hidden behind Bolshevism, will become evident. And then the world will crush out again the world program, which at times has seemed so near success. There will probably be more light upon this world program as a result of the Russian Cajal Soviet system than from any other attempt to realize it. For five generations, the world has lived in a false light supposed to be shed by the French Revolution. It is now known that the revolution was not the revolution of the French people, but the disorders of a minority who sought to impose upon the French people the very plan which is now being considered. It was the French people who ultimately put down the so-called French Revolution. And France, as a result of that upheaval of a well-organized minority, has been bound by Jewish control ever since. The Russian Revolution will go down in history with no such false halo of romance around it. The world now knows it for what it is. The world will soon know whose was the money and whose were the brains that fostered it, and from what part of the world the principal impetus came. The Russian upheaval is racial, not political or economic. It conceals beneath all its false socialism and its empty mouthings of human brotherhood a clear-cut plan of racial imperialism, which is not Russian, and which the common sense and interest of the world will speedily stamp out. That's the end of this section, published on August 28th, 1920.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.